totality of Catholic apostolates in the United States. And it's good to be with Kristen again. She and I are colleagues in this national leadership of the pro-life movement, intersect regularly and frequently, and good to be together, Kristen, again today with you. Well, brothers and sisters, the Year of Mercy has intimate and deep connections with the pro-life movement. And when our Holy Father first explained the meaning of the Year of Mercy in going back to Divine Mercy Sundays ago, and he issued the document explaining his vision, there are a couple of ways in which we see in some of his quotes, which I want to mention briefly here, what this intersection consists of. Mercy is not just about the forgiveness of sins. The forgiveness of sins is because of something else. The unconditional, eternal, unmerited love of God for us. Now, how did that first manifest itself? Not when he forgave your first sin. It manifested itself when, without asking for it and without earning it, he brought you out of nothingness and into life. That's mercy. That's his first act of mercy to you. He made you. He made me. Therefore, the continuation of mercy and the living out of mercy has this dual dimension. Obviously, yes, the forgiveness of sins. But why the forgiveness of sins? Because he wants us to live. Sin leads to death. The reason he offers his forgiveness is because he wants us alive, here and hereafter. And if mercy, therefore, is to be, as our Holy Father said from the beginning of this Year of Mercy, something that we not only receive from the Father, but that we imitate in our life and carry out, well, then carrying out mercy means giving life and rescuing those who are in danger of death. Here's what the Holy Father says. Psalm 146, he says, attests to the concrete signs of his mercy, quote, he secures justice for the oppressed. In short, the mercy of God is not an abstract idea, but a concrete reality through which he reveals his love as that of a father or mother moved to the very depths of love for their child. And then he goes on to say that his hope in us living this Year of Mercy is, quote, to look forward to the experience of opening our hearts to those living on the outermost fringes of society, fringes that modern society itself creates. How many uncertain and painful situations, the Pope goes on, there are in the world today? How many are the wounds borne by the flesh of those who have no voice because their cry is muffled and drowned out? Let us open our eyes and see the misery of the world, the wounds of our brothers and sisters who are denied their dignity. And let's recognize that we're compelled to heed their cry for help. Make you think of the unborn, oppressed, legally defined out of existence by Roe v. Wade, and then torn and crushed, burned and thrown in the garbage daily by the thousands. Nothing takes more human life than abortion. That remains true in our nation and in our world. And as Pope Francis said in Evangelii Gaudium, among those for whom the Church cares, none are more defenseless than these children. As he said in Laudato Si, everything's interconnected. So that the disregard of the right to life of a tiny human being at the beginning of life is completely inconsistent with care for some endangered species in the environment. All is connected indeed. And that instructs and informs us as we move forward in the last month of this election season. Because it is no coincidence that the Year of Mercy for us in the United States essentially corresponds to our election season, finishes a couple of weeks after the monumental decisions that are about to be made at the voting booth. And this is an act of mercy to pray and act in ways that we can influence the outcome of this election. The question is, will that mercy be shown to our nation? As our United States bishops wrote back in 1998 in their document, Living the Gospel of Life, they said, we get the public officials we deserve. Their virtue or lack thereof, I continue to quote, is a reflection not only on them, but on us. So we're going to get what we deserve, but hopefully in his evaluation of what we deserve, the Lord will take account of our plea for mercy. So what do we do? What can we do in this regard? First of all, let me point out, and I wrote two books in preparation for this election of 2016. One of them came out last summer, Abolishing Abortion. I have complimentary copies here for you. Many of you have it already. And in this book, I lay out the essential obstacles in the way and pressing duties for both the church and the state as we look at the question of how we can eradicate or abolish abortion. The other book that came out more recently, also on the table back there, takes the entire lectionary and for all the Sundays of all three cycles, gives to both preachers and those in the pews an idea of how those readings contain and express pro-life themes. So you'll find that very, very useful as well. But back to something I say in here, we have to understand something. Where a candidate or where a political party stands on abortion is not simply a policy issue. It is about the kind of government that we have. Sometimes people will say it's about policy, and particularly the Democrats will say something like, well, you know, we're interested in reducing the numbers of abortions. That's why we have various programs aimed at poverty and helping pregnant women, et cetera, et cetera. Listen, we support those programs 100,000%. I've stood at the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee to stand with Democratic legislators in favor of legislation that would assist women not to feel like they have to have an abortion. So we're not in any way, you know, downgrading or making light of those efforts and the sincerity behind those efforts. But let's make something perfectly clear. If we have in an election two candidates who are disputing with one another the best policy for reducing crime in a neighborhood, you're not going to hear a candidate campaigning for the right to crime. They agree on the principle. We've got to protect people from crime. So it's not a question of whether to protect them from crime, but how and what's going to be most effective. Well, we learn by trial and error. But on this matter, it's not a dispute about how do we best protect these children. It's the question of whether we do. And that's not a dispute simply about policy. It's a dispute about principle. And that's not simply a question of one or another issue or court decision. It's a more fundamental question. What kind of government do we have, and what kind of power do we give to someone when we vote for them? We have two parties right now that disagree on that fundamental question. You can't get any more fundamental than that. I'm asking for your vote. Fine. What do you think that accomplishes? I vote you into office. So what happens next? You have power over me? What does it mean? You can put me to death? I'm going to put you in office. And so what does that mean? Does that mean you have now a veto power over human rights, or that we're going to come begging to you with our hands folded as if the Congress or the President or the court gives us our rights? Or does the king have a king? Must the law obey the law? Is there a limit to the authority of those we elect? It certainly is. But there are candidates and parties in this country that don't believe that anymore. We are not talking about one issue. We're not even talking about the most important issue. We're talking about everything. If a government's not willing to protect your life, it's not willing to protect your money. It's not willing to protect your freedom. It's not willing to protect anything. If you take away the life of that child, guess what? You took away her education, her health care, her right to vote, her right to be protected from terrorism, her right to immigrate, her right to do anything. And if we think somehow that Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to build a society where, you know, the death penalty is not in place anymore. You know, we're going to protect the guilty. We're never going to learn how to protect the guilty when we still don't know how to protect the innocent. We're never going to learn how to feed the hungry when we don't know how to feed our own children. And we're never going to promote peace between nations if we can't promote peace between a mother and her own child. Nor will we learn how to welcome immigrants across the border of our country if we don't know how to welcome them across the border of the womb. We will be building on quicksand. We are right now. And now, this is the choice before the electorate. Oh, and so many people are distracted and disturbed by the idiosyncrasies and personalities of the candidates, or their history. I am not electing somebody for his or her past history or sins. I am electing someone to do a job, a very specific job, whether they are a member of Congress, whether they're in the White House, whether they're a governor. And brothers and sisters, the way that we can best guide people right now in terms of evaluating the candidates and the issues in the light of the teachings of the church is to help them understand the positions of the parties. And that's why we've given you these platform pieces. And if anyone doesn't have them, you all know Janet Moran, our executive director at Priestwise. She'll give you one if you don't have one. You take more than one if you want. These have been legally approved according to the norms of law for distribution by churches. So we're issuing a national call to pastors to put these in their parish bulletin between now and the election. And, you know, we've always been nice, you know, at Priests for Life. We kind of offer everything to the churches. This time we're going to put a little edge to it. We're going to challenge the pastors to let us know that they've done it, and if they don't, tell us why.
Good.
Because in this book, I won't go into this in detail now, we don't have time. But in this book, I identify a fundamental problem we have right now in the church. And we as Catholic leaders need to look at this and address it. While we fight mandates from the government restricting our religious freedom, and many of you are petitioners in this, the various lawsuits against the HHS mandate, Legatus and EWTN and various others, we at Priests for Life are as well, we're being told to violate our faith, and we're saying no. But we're protesting in court mandates of the government, but we're imposing mandates of our own through the institutional church, many dioceses, saying things like, and I quote the memos here in this book, I leave the names out, but I quote the memos, saying to us priests, saying to you as Catholic leaders of 501c3 tax-exempt organizations, oh, well, they'll be careful because you cannot even appear to support or discredit a particular candidate or party. A, that is not the law. B, that is impossible for us to follow that advice. How can you have a major party saying the unborn child should be protected, another one who says it can be discarded, and a church that says the baby should be protected, and how can you proclaim the teaching of the church and not appear to be favoring one and discrediting the other? I don't know how that works. One and one is two. It's not 7.5. And it's not zero. The only way you can appear not to be favoring or discrediting a political party in our day and age with these issues that are being debated is to be silent about the teaching of the church. And then you discredit yourself. You know what? Faced with the choice of discrediting myself or discrediting a political party, I'll choose the latter any day of the week. So brothers and sisters, going back to this, very simple, very clear. It's the words of the platforms themselves that were issued this past summer by the two major parties. And it can be used, and it's very helpful for people. Secondly, prayer, electionprayer.com is a prayer website. We have Janet will give you the prayer cards if you haven't taken them already. May I encourage you in these weeks that remain to foster this prayer in whatever way you can and choose to. I think you'll find it a very helpful and useful prayer. The The third thing I want to bring to your attention is we are going to put a full-page ad in a number of national papers and diocesan papers as well, with a few quotes. The ad is here. It's called, this will be coming up in about a week or two. We're going to have a national press conference as well with some priests, and we're going to touch on some of these things. It says, clear guidance from two saints and a few hundred bishops about voting. It quotes Living the Gospel of Life, as I already mentioned. And it quotes Mother Teresa and John Paul II. John Paul saying, the common outcry which is justly made on behalf of human rights, for example, the right to health, home, work, family, and culture, is false and illusory if the right to life, the most basic and fundamental right, and condition for all other personal rights, is not defended with maximum determination. We're going to urge pastors to put quotes like this in their parish bulletin between now and the election, and if they don't, to tell us why. And I can tell you exactly why some of them won't do it, because it appears to favor one or another political candidate or party. We also have a website called youneedtovote.org. And the reason for this one is to help people get out of the spiritual paralysis in which many find themselves. Because again, they say, oh, this is a tough election. I don't feel like I can vote for either person. And my answer to that is, so what? Is this about making you feel good, or is it about the common good? Doesn't every choice in your life constitute a choice between two imperfect things? You go to a restaurant. You know how many restaurants I go to that I wish I could have my lobster tail with the melted butter and they just don't serve it? You know, in every choice in life, and I'm not saying one is as important as the other. All I'm saying is in every choice in life is always a choice of what are the best available options. People get into a spiritual paralysis when it comes to election because now they're not comparing the available options. They're comparing the options with some kind of ideal option that isn't there. Listen, we say at the beginning of Mass, we ask forgiveness for what we have done and what we have failed to do. You don't escape responsibility for the outcome of the election simply because you don't vote. You still have responsibility for what happens. Because what didn't happen is what could have happened had you voted. It's not difficult to navigate people through these waters, but if you go to youneedtovote.org, you'll find some help. Before Kristen comes up now, I want to just give you two other little resources here. One of them is just above and beyond the booklet that we have where we have one another's contact information. This is some social media contact information from our team, and I bring you the greetings of our whole team, by the way, Alveda King and our priests, and Teresa and Kevin Burke of Rachel's Vineyard, Brian Kemper of our youth outreach. Many of you know these people, all constituting our Priest for Life team. And finally, looking ahead to January, so many of us are in Washington for the March for Life. And I wanted to let you know that morning, as has been happening for the last 23 years, we have an interdenominational prayer service. We start with Mass, but then we have an interdenominational prayer service in Constitution Hall. Fabulous experience. If you're coming, if you're involved with organizing buses or groups that are coming, you may want to consider not only joining us for that, but you're also invited to co-sponsor the event, and this letter will explain a little bit more about what that entails. Lord, have mercy on our nation, and let us exercise mercy as we give life to those whom you call into being, and as we serve the needs of those in danger of death. And Lord, as we do defend life, give us the joy of finding you who are life eternal. Amen. Amen.